your system.
All right. Yeah. Okay. We're up and running on that.
Perfect.
Okay. So Stephen asks, in Joshua chapter 3, it tells the story about the Jordan River stopping its flow some 25 miles upstream from where the Israelites later crossed it. It also states that the riverbed dried up to where they could walk across it without sinking into mud. Are there any physics to explain these two phenomena, or do you think it's 100% divine intervention?
Well, number one, it's for a generation that did not witness the God spreading the or parting the Red Sea. So it's like here's a second opportunity. So yeah, God parted the Red Sea so they could escape the Egyptian army. And now he's parting the Jordan River so that they could see that God is with them. And, I've been to the Jordan River. God didn't really have to part the Jordan River. I mean, it would have been relatively straightforward to have the, hordes of Israel cross over that river, because it's not like the Mississippi. So I think he did it just to basically display to the people that were born during those 40 years of the wilderness experience, hey, I'm the same God that was with your parents and grandparents. The miracle I did in the Red Sea, I'm still with you. Don't be afraid of these people as you enter the land. Yes, there's giants there. There are well-fortified cities, but I'm with you. And there's been a lot written on exactly how that could have happened. You know, people talk about, well, if you get certain wind conditions, you can actually, cause water to be blowing up. To me, what is amazing is, yes, there are ways you can come up with extraordinary phenomena, a very powerful wind blowing in a right direction that stops the flow, or you could have, some people said, a tectonic event where you get a rupture and the water flowing down goes down instead of flowing out to the Gulf of Aqaba. That could have happened, or into the Dead Sea. So there are ways to explain it physically. To me, what makes it miraculous is the timing. I mean, just like with the Red Sea, God parted it, and he parted in such a way that there was no mud. It was actually dry. I mean, that's the amazing thing. To me, that's a bigger miracle than actually getting the water to move away, is the fact that they were able to cross on dry land with carts, with animals, and make it to the other side. But people say, well, this could happen. It's just a coincidence. But here's the real problem. The entire Israelite throng and all their animals and goods cross the Red Sea. And just as they get across, the Egyptian army says, hey, we're going to go after them. We're going to take advantage of the situation. And the moment they enter into the Red Sea, the waters collapse upon them and the Egyptian army is destroyed. Well, likewise, here we see supernatural timing. The Jordan River stops flowing, and we see a drying up of the riverbed, an immediate drying up. They cross over, and the Jordan River flows again. So basically, it's God telling the Israelites, look, I'm a God that can perform these kinds of miracles. I got control over nature. I got control over the timing. Don't worry about these powerful people in their cities that are in this land. I'm with you. And, my goal is that we rid the land of reprobate behavior that's here, because at that time, the land of Canaan was the most reprobate region in the entire world. And so it's like, if this isn't stopped, it's going to infect the whole human species. Very similar to what happened the days before the flood, where God recognized a reprobation was in danger of taking over the entire human species, and it was necessary to remove the cancer. Well, likewise, God says, you're going to be my instrument to remove the cancer, and here's my evidence that I'm going to use you in powerful supernatural ways.
Thank you, Hugh. Tony Zappavina says, if ancient humans ever had offspring with Neanderthals, would any resulting offspring compromise their soul, their human soul, that would prevent future generations from salvation? Do we still retain a portion of that DNA potentially. And I just want to remind everybody, tell us where you are. Makes it a lot more interesting. Go ahead, Hugh.
Yeah, well, first of all, it's not settled whether this interbreeding actually took place. I mean, amongst our scholar team, there's debate as to just how strong the evidence is. I remember listening to a dialogue between Sue Dykes and Fazal Rana. And Fuzz said, well, looking at the research, I'm about 80% persuaded that the interbreeding did take place. Well, Sue's response was the opposite. She says, at best, I'm only 20% persuaded that it took place. You know, and her main point was that we have humans and Neanderthals facing the same environmental pressures. And so this DNA similarity could be attributed to the fact that both, you know, species were experiencing that microevolution. After all, the evidence is basically based on the fact that Europeans to the most, Asians to a lesser degree, Pacific Islanders to an even lesser degree, show more DNA similarity with that part of the genome that we have from Neanderthals than we see with sub-Saharan Africans. And the comment was, well, the sub-Saharan African humans had no contact with the Neanderthals. So that actually is the evidence that interbreeding did take place. However, the people who published the results making that claim did note that given how little of the difference is, that the level of interbreeding had to be extremely low. In fact, they commented that the level of interbreeding, if it's real, would be actually less than the sexual contact that's going on today between humans and the great apes. And so they're basically saying that this is evidence that there is a strong taboo against bestiality right from the beginning of human beings. And this is consistent with what you see in the book of Leviticus. The strongest injunction against human behavior is that of bestiality. We're told to avoid it like the plague, and anybody who engages in that is to be severely dealt with. And understandably so, because there's a battle going on between Satan and God, and God is intent on preserving the image of God. Satan is intent on destroying the image of God. So from a theological perspective, I could go either way, because I could see from what the Bible says about the sons of God and the Nephilim in chapter 6, that Satan is very intent on trying to destroy the image of God and to do so through sexual contact. And so this to me would be consistent with Satan also trying to encourage this kind of interbreeding. But I could also see God stepping in and limiting the damage so that the image of God is preserved. And that's the point that Fuzz and I make. Even if the evidence stands up and shows that this interbreeding took place, the level of interbreeding is so extremely low, it would have no impact on the image of God for any of us today or any of us in the last several thousand years. The question that's being raised here is, how would it impact the actual offspring? And that's an unknown question or answer. I mean, it's possible that these offspring would have been so damaged that they wouldn't have survived very long. They would only last, they might reproduce, but what they reproduce would be quickly weeded out. Because, not all humans that lived 40, 50,000 years ago pass on their DNA to humans today. Most of them do not. And so if this was a problem with the image of God, it would have been a problem for a few generations only. But my big answer is, I really don't know what impact that would have had on the offspring. I could see God stepping in and making sure that this had no impact on the offspring, but I could see it going the other way as well.
Thank you, Hugh. Our friend Steve Rogstad here in the Los Angeles area asks, is there any scientific evidence for the long lifespans of humans described in Genesis?
Yeah, there is no scientific evidence. Not that I would expect any, since we're deep, you know, going back fairly deep into past human history. This would have been during the time of the last ice age. What we do have is some historical evidence, because you look at the oldest writings we have in the Persian Gulf area, they do talk about a line of kings that lived many thousands of years. Now, in fact, they actually claim that the lifespans are longer than we see recorded in the Bible, but that's consistent because if you look at the rest of what you see in the Sumerian and Akkadian ancient written records, is that there is a strong propensity towards exaggeration. I mean, they exaggerated all of their accomplishments. So in that sense, I'm not surprised that the claimed lifespans were on the order of 5 to 10,000 years compared to the 800 or 900 years we see in the Bible. But the whole point is there is extra biblical historical evidence that at least some humans were living that long. And what I've written about in Navigating Genesis is what it would take for humans to be able to live that long. And I think one of the most interesting studies is that done by two astronomers, Wolfendale and Ehrlichan, a British and a Russian astronomer, have been collaborating literally for over 30 years, studying the fact that when they look at the cosmic rays that are impinging, they've been accumulating evidence that the heavy nuclei, fast-moving cosmic rays, and those are the cosmic rays that do us the most damage, that over 95% of those come from a single supernova eruption that erupted sometime during the past 100,000 years. And the point there is humans living before that supernova would have been subjected to a lot less cosmic ray damage than humans living after that supernova. That's one requirement. A second requirement is you need to avoid igneous rocks to a large degree. However, what we see in the book of Genesis is that humans were not occupying the whole globe in the days before the flood, and hence could have been protected from exposure to these igneous rocks. Once you got the launch of the Neolithic Revolution about 11,000 years ago, everybody gets exposed to igneous rocks. But if you've got people living in a sedimentary plain and they're not engaging in the trade or manufacturing roads and cities to a large degree, I could conceive of people not being exposed to the uranium and thorium that exists in igneous rocks. And that too would give them the possibility of living longer. The biblical text actually talks about how humans at that time were commanded to avoid eating meat. And if you want to live to be 800 or 900 years, you don't want to be eating meat. For all of you who are worried about your meat consumption today, I would say don't worry about it. If you're only going to live to be 120 years, eating meat is not going to load your body with enough heavy metals to cause significant health issues. Although there are certain forms of meat I would recommend you avoid just because they are very rich in heavy metals. And last of all, there would need to be a change in the telomerase activity going on in the chromosomes of human beings. Because right now, our chromosomes actually shorten as we get older and older. And that actually lengthens our lifespan. If it wasn't for the shortening of our chromosomes, we would die much earlier deaths from cancer. But because those chromosomes are shortening at the rate they are, it actually extends our lifespan in the context of our greater risk to cancer. But my whole point is the cancer risk would have been a lot less in the days before that supernova eruption and the days before exposure to igneous rocks. I believe that's the chapter we're giving away for free when you go to reasons.org/Ross, that chapter in Navigating Genesis. So yeah, people want to dig into it in more detail, they can get that chapter. And incidentally, I believe that only a few humans living before the flood lived that long. You'll see a table in Navigating Genesis indicating that at least 90% of human beings were having their lives terminated by being murdered by their fellow human beings, and likely being murdered when they're in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. And so what I think is chilling is to realize that in the days before the flood, the average human lifespan in all likelihood was much less than it is today, which gives us an appreciation why God had to step in with a flood, because humanity literally was in danger of self-extermination.
Thank you, Hugh. From downtown Los Angeles, we get a question from Don Hank.
Here, I'm going to terminate that phone. Hang on.
There you go.
Okay, no more robocalls.
Don Hank says he has heard before your good teaching on animal death before sin. Can you drill down on why there was death before sin so that we can speak to Christians who would disagree? Was it a foreshadowing of Christ?
Okay, good question. Timely question. I've been bombarded on both my Facebook and Twitter pages by a post I made that really had nothing to do with animal death before Adam sinned, but they jumped on me with that subject. So yeah, I've had to respond to that and basically make the point that the Bible tells us that Adam's sin brought about human death. Nowhere in the Bible does it say that there was no death of plants and animals before human sin. Now, my young earth friends will say, well, yes, but nowhere in the Bible does it say that there was death of plants and animals before human sin. The Bible is silent on the issue. So that's where Christians divide. Some say there was no death of plants and animals before Adam sinned. Others say that there were. I would argue that based on the Bible alone, we would have to conclude that there was animal death going on, certainly plant death. By the way, a lot of my young earth friends do agree that there was plant death going on, because after all, the animals have to be eating plants to survive. And they make the interesting claim that the Bible only attributes life to animals, not to plants. But actually, that's incorrect. The Bible uses the same words for life and death with respect to plants that it does for animals. So that's a biblical mistake. But I think there's another biblical mistake. The Bible repeatedly tells us the laws of physics have not changed from the time that God created the universe. They will change in the future when God completes his works of redemption. But as it tells us in Jeremiah 33 and in Romans 8, these laws have remained in effect. They're immutable. What you see in Jeremiah 33, God says, you Jews change your mind all the time, but I'm a God that does not change. And as evidence, look at the laws that govern the heavens and the earth. As they don't change, I don't change. Well, if you've got these laws of physics in place, gravity, electromagnetism, and thermodynamics, that guarantees that you will have death. Unless, of course, you got access to the tree of life. And that's what we notice is that the moment that Adam and Eve, sinned, God blocked access to the tree of life. Evidently, the tree of life was the only way you could reverse the effects of thermodynamics. And we also see passages in the Bible where God talks about how he shows his love and care for lions and eagles and ravens, and then he provides those animals with prey. And so I think young earth creationists are making a mistake when they would claim that it would be unloving for God to allow carnivorous activity to take place. You've got these passages in Job and Psalms that say otherwise. Now, in terms of why it's so critical that there must be this death of plants and animals before Adam sinned, God's intent is that there would be billions of human beings that would be redeemed from sin and evil, which means that the planet must have the capacity to sustain billions of human beings. And that's only possible if you have a huge treasure chest in the crust of the earth of biodeposits, the remains of previous living creatures. And if you look in the crust of the earth, we know that there's a minimum of 76 quadrillion tons of dead biological material that's there in the form of coal, oil, natural gas. Those actually make up a tiny percentage of the biodeposits. Clathrates make up much more than all the coal, oil, and natural gas combined. That's basically frozen in methane. And then you've got limestone and marble. Limestone and marble make up the bulk of the biodeposits. Now, some people have argued that they're not biological. It is true you can get limestone without biological activity. However, the isotopes, the carbon isotopes we see in limestone and marble tells us they came from once living material. And so we humans are the beneficiaries of 3.8 billion years of previous death of life on planet Earth. Nevertheless, the Bible is clear, no human death until Adam's sin. The most explicit text, Romans 5:12, death through sin because of Adam's offense was visited upon all people. Notice it doesn't say all life, it says all people, and it says death through sin. The plants and animals don't sin. We're the only creatures on the face of the earth that have that capability.
Very good. Thank you, Hugh. Well, it's 10:47, so it's time to get started with the lesson. Welcome, everybody, to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradox class. Hugh will be teaching us this Sunday, as he has since we've been on Zoom, but we have a special treat next week. Hugh is going to be teaching on Zoom to another church, and we have the privilege of having Karina Marco teach us. She's from Mexico, and we're going to start at 10:45, not 10:30, so we won't be taking questions ahead of time, but we will be taking questions after her talk. She's a planetary astronomer, specializes in how planets are formed and the basics of planetary formation. So this is going to be really exciting. It fits right in with what Hugh has been teaching. So, Hugh, why don't you open us in prayer, if you would, and we'll get to your talk. We have some other great questions coming up, but we'll hold them until you're done.
Okay, very good. Well, Father in heaven, we thank you for giving us this technology where we can meet together in spite of this pandemic. And Father, we again pray that you would really empower those scientists and epidemiologists as they try to develop therapeutic drugs to blunt the impact of this virus and also a vaccine. And Father, I pray that we would all learn from our experiences here about how we can maintain better health for the general population. But also thank you for reminding us of just how important it is to have intimate social contact with one another. And we look forward to that day. We can actually fellowship with one another face to face. But also, Father, we pray that we would not neglect this amazing technology, which allows us to experience relationships with one another, literally all over the world. And we look forward to how both of that can be combined in the new creation. So, Father, I pray that you'd enable us to receive more of your life, your love and truth, as we dialogue with one another. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, with that, I will begin with some announcements. You heard that I'm going to be teaching in another church this next Sunday. And actually, these past couple of months, I've been asked by churches and seminaries if I could develop some material on suffering, the physics of suffering, but also what the Bible tells us about suffering, suffering in the present creation, and what it's going to be like in the new creation. So I've actually prepared a series of talks, and I thought, just so you're aware, the church where I serve on the pastoral staff has asked me, once this virus calms down enough, where we can actually have meetings in person, we're going to launch a series. They want me to launch a series on going through the first dozen chapters of Genesis and kind of break it up into mini series, probably a series on each chapter. So they've asked me, I did that like decades ago, but there's a lot of updated material. So we're going to launch that series the moment that we can meet in person. And we won't wait too long because I think there'll come a time where we can socially distance people in a large auditorium, and Reasons to Believe has offered the use of their conference room to make that possible, which means that we'd be able to accommodate at least 40, if not 50 people socially distanced in that room, and then we'll launch that series. However, some of you may be aware, Los Angeles County here is one of the COVID-19 hotspots. And so when we're done with this series on the remarkable designs we see in our planetary system, we're going to launch a series on what the Bible and science says about suffering and how that can actually help us get more in tune with God's Holy Spirit in taking advantage of suffering for the purposes that he has intended it. So that's an announcement of what we're going to do once we get done with this series. And with that, let me share screen. Okay, you should be seeing my visual, and I'm going to speak for about 30 minutes, and then we'll devote the rest of the time for questions and issues you want to raise up. And literally, we'll take on any question that doesn't have to pertain to the topic. And again, if you don't get to ask your questions, you're welcome to post questions to me on my Facebook and Twitter page. And I do the best I can to try to keep up with all the questions that I get. And if you're not aware, Reasons to Believe does have a 24/7 YouTube channel, and you can subscribe for free. So you'll see all that on the reasons.org website. And you'll actually see quite a bit on the designs, the supernatural designs of our planetary system. And this book, Improbable Planet, what I'm trying to do in this series is give you an update of what's been discovered since that book came out in 2016. And you can get a free chapter of that book and any of my books for that matter at reasons.org/Ross. So this is a passage that you see both in the Old Testament and the New Testament. And as I mentioned before, whenever you see a passage repeated both in the Old Testament and New Testament, it's worth paying attention to. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. And to me, what's remarkable is that when God created Adam and Eve, he created Adam and Eve at that time when our planet had the greatest diversity of life that it's ever had. I mean, at the time God created Adam and Eve, there were 8.5 million eukaryotic species. These are species the chromosomes in the nucleus, where you had to distinguish from the more primitive life forms, the unicellular life forms that don't have a nucleus. 8.5 million species. How many species are there? The prokaryotes could be even north of 10 million, but that's a much harder number to count. But never before in the history of our planet. Matter of fact, if you go from the origin of life up to the moment God created human beings, we see an increasing number of species on the planet, and it reaches a theoretical maximum right at the time that God created Adam and Eve. Again, evidence for God supernaturally endowing the earth with his life. The very fact that we see that Earth is carrying the theoretical maximum number of species given the size of our planet. Of course, there are not that many species on the planet today because human activity has been causing many of them to go extinct. And incidentally, that's an argument I use, that it must be God that's responsible for these species. If you look at mammals, over half the mammals that existed at the time God created Adam and Eve have gone extinct. How many new ones have come into existence? Zero. But as it says in Genesis chapter 1, for 6 days God creates, on the seventh day he stops, and we're still in that seventh day. And so what we see now is just the natural process. The supernatural interventions are not happening. And so that explains why we see such a difference in the pre-human era compared to the human era. Okay, these are the eight planets in our solar system. I could take that same passage in Psalm 24 and 1 Corinthians 10 and basically make a paraphrase. The solar system is the Lord's and everything in it. These past few weeks, we've been looking at about how different our planetary system is from exoplanetary systems, and how every one of the eight planets in our solar system plays a role in making advanced life possible on Earth. And even the mass in the orbit of our moon plays a role in sustaining the stability of the dynamics of our solar system so advanced life is possible on the Earth. And yeah, as you look at this is everything to scale in terms of size. So you get to see just how small our planet Earth is relative to, say, Jupiter and Saturn. And then you got Mars and Mercury, even tinier. Okay, last week we spent a lot of time on the Grand Tack, basically making the point that we see a unique feature in our solar system where we got the gas giant planets being born beyond the ice line. They migrate into the ice line, at least Jupiter does, and then they turn around and reverse. Migration of gas giants is common amongst exoplanetary systems, explains why we see so many of these gas giants and Jupiter-type planets orbiting their stars closer than Earth orbits the sun, because because of the migration they experienced in the early history of those exoplanetary systems. And I'm not going to repeat all that. You can download the video or the audio, it's your choice, at paradoxes.org. We actually archive all the classes here at Paradoxes, so you can get caught up there. But this is the part we didn't cover last week. How this movement of Jupiter and Saturn towards our star, the sun, and then reversing and moving back. And as I pointed out last week, what causes this unique reversal is, excuse me, you know, last week I was telling my wife that it was the first time I've been able to speak for more than an hour and not have any kind of asthma reaction, literally the first time in the past 15 years. And I was hoping it would continue today, but not so much luck. So, but I'll be all right. Okay, it's not COVID-19. It's just my asthma is doing a whole lot better than it was even 4 months ago. Okay, what happens when these, what makes this special is this, you only get a reversal if you got Jupiter being the most massive of the planets in the planetary system, where it's got more than half the total mass of all the planets in the planetary system. It must orbit a little bit beyond where Jupiter orbits right now. And then you need the second most massive planet to be the next closest of the gas planets to the sun. That would be Saturn. And then you want smaller ones beyond that. This enables this Grand Tack motion to take place where you get Jupiter and Saturn making a significant migration towards the sun, stopping. And what causes them to stop is that Saturn moves faster than Jupiter does. And it reaches a point where Jupiter makes exactly three orbits for every two orbits of the sun, which causes them to reverse direction and migrate back out. And Jupiter winds up in virtually the same spot that it started out in. That too is critical to make this whole thing work. And again, you can get the recording of last week. But what I want to focus on is that this Grand Tack movement eradicates the E belt of asteroids. It thins out and restructures the main belt of asteroids and explains the properties of the Kuiper Belt and the Oort cloud. And there's a debate on whether or not we do know that the Oort cloud is the biggest of the asteroid and comet belts of the solar system by far. Oort cloud's got more comets and asteroids than the other four belts combined. The main belt is the closest belt to our Earth. It's the belt that exists between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. The Kuiper Belt exists just beyond the orbit of Neptune, and we'll talk about the other two belts in a minute. But the whole point is we have the asteroid belts we do because of the fine-tuned nature of this grand tack movement of Jupiter and Saturn, and to a much lesser degree, that of Neptune and Uranus in terms of inward movement, although Neptune makes a major outward movement. I mentioned last week, Neptune actually starts off closer to the sun than Uranus, but then gets kicked way out as a result of this. Okay, here is the asteroid belt that existed between the orbit of Jupiter, that's the outer circle, and then you see the next inner circle, the orbit of Mars. This is what the asteroid belt looked like, the main belt looked like, before the Grand Tack movement took place. So you can see there were a lot of asteroids in this main belt at that time. And then we have this migration taking place where you've got Jupiter starting off just outside of its present orbit. It moves in to about twice the distance that Earth is from the sun, 2 astronomical units. It stops at that point, reverses, changes direction, migrates back out, but the migration actually stops. It stops at the present orbit that Jupiter is at and has been stable there for the last 3.8 billion. Well, actually some now realize this Grand Tack movement in all likelihood happened early rather than late. Less than 100 million years after the formation of the solar system, as opposed to an older theory that put it at about 700 to 750 million years after the formation of the solar system. Recent research is overwhelmingly establishing that this happened early rather than a little bit later. But the net result was it cleared out the E-belt. The E-belt is that belt that extends halfway from Jupiter to Mars, and from that point all the way to Mars. So the net result is we have this. And so all the inner asteroids to a large degree have been cleared out. I say to a large degree because occasionally we get gravitational perturbations from Jupiter and Saturn that will disturb one of the main belt asteroids and cause it to come into what we call a near-Earth encounter, where it gets such a large eccentricity that occasionally it will go into the inner solar system. And so we do have a few near-Earth asteroids, and some of them actually do collide with the Earth over the history of the Earth. And you'll see a whole bunch of these asteroids that share the orbit of Jupiter. And they share the orbit of Jupiter, what are called the L4 and L5 Lagrange points along the orbit. If you go 60 degrees forward or backwards from the orbit of Jupiter, you've got a place where a small body can share the same orbit with a big body. It's stable, literally stable for billions of years. It's stable if all you got is one star in the system, and we don't have any other big planets. So the fact that Jupiter has over 2/3 of the total mass of all the solar system planets actually allows Jupiter's orbit to have a large number of what we call these Trojan asteroids, asteroids that populate about 60 degrees forward in the orbit and about 60 degrees back. Occasionally, some of them get disturbed by the gravitational interaction of Saturn, but only occasionally. And yes, these Trojans would have been more numerous billions of years ago is what they look like right now. But the whole point is we have this very dense belt of asteroids that gets thinned out. Now, if Jupiter had gotten closer than 2 astronomical units, twice the distance that Earth is from the sun, a lot more of these asteroids would have been cleared out, either driven into the sun or completely tossed out of the solar system, or tossed out into one of the outer comet and asteroid belts like the Kuiper Belt or the Oort cloud. As it is, a significant population remains because Jupiter didn't migrate too far in and reverse direction and migrated outward. And so we are the beneficiaries of this significant main belt of asteroids. And I'll explain the benefits we get from these asteroids within a few minutes. Now, there's research that actually, okay, there's new technology where we're able to actually see asteroid and comet belts orbiting other stars. Now, we don't actually see the asteroids and comets. What we do see is the dust that's generated. So, for example, if you look at the Kuiper Belt and the main belt, there's actually a little bit of dust that's distributed in that belt as a result of collisions. There's enough of these comets and asteroids that they bump into one another, and when they bump into one another, they create a very thin dust and gas cloud, and we can actually detect that because dust gives us, it basically creates radiation in the deep infrared and millimeter wavelengths. And so we've been able to look at stars relatively close to our own star, the sun, and recognize that we see stars falling into two categories. You've got stars that don't have any asteroid or comet belts at all, none that we can detect. And we do have the technological capability of detecting asteroid and comet belts that are much less populated than we see in our solar system. But we also see a whole bunch where they have asteroid and comet belts that are hundreds, sometimes thousands of times bigger than what we see in our solar system. And the understanding is as follows. Namely, that if you take into account all the instrumental biases in detecting planets outside of our solar system, it is really clear that the vast majority of exoplanets are small planets, not big planets. Yes, we discovered the big ones first because they were the easiest to detect with a radial velocity method. But now we have a variety of methods. It's clear that small planets far outnumber the big planets, and that we have many exoplanetary systems where we don't detect any gas giants at all. And if you don't have any gas giants, that means you don't have bodies big enough to gravitationally disturb the primordial belts of asteroids and comets. And so that would explain why you've got so many stars with enormous comet and asteroid belts. And then you've got those that where they do have gas giants, but the gas giants are orbiting farther away, or they're gas giants that haven't migrated inward. And the vast majority, as we mentioned in previous weeks, where you do have gas giants, about 83% of them have migrated much closer to their stars than Jupiter and Saturn has in the past. And this has the impact of really obliterating the asteroid and comet belts to a far greater degree than we see in our solar system. And basically making the point that the asteroid and comet belts that we see orbiting our sun, based on the observations we have so far, apparently it is unique. We've yet to find an analog to what we see here in a planetary system. And so, yes, we look at other stars, they either have no detectable asteroid or comet belts, or they got asteroid and comet belts that are hundreds of thousands of times bigger. And clearly, if they're hundreds of thousands of times bigger, you're going to have a problem for life, at least for advanced life, because these rocky planets are going to get bombarded all the time, not just once every 10 million years by an asteroid that is, say, 5 kilometers across or bigger, but this is going to be happening literally on timescales of millennia rather than timescales of tens of millions of years. And that would make any kind of a life beyond microbial life impossible. It may even bring about the extinction of a microbial life. On the other hand, we do need at least some delivery of comets and asteroids to the Earth for advanced life to be possible. And we'll get to that. Here I wanted to show a comment. This is one of several that I've found in the scientific literature, basically making the point that the grand tack of the gas giant and Neptune-type planets we see in our solar system in such a way as to make advanced life possible on one of the rocky planets is so incredibly fine-tuned that we really don't have any hope of finding a system that's like our planetary system. So here's one quote: other planetary systems with giant planets are not expected to have experienced a grand tack-like evolutionary path. And I just was reading a paper a few days ago making the point that it's unlikely we'll ever find an exoplanetary system where we see gas giant planets like Jupiter and Saturn orbiting where they are, where we also have comet and asteroid belts that coexist with them. One researcher said at best, only 1% of exoplanetary systems would match this, and that this is only one of many requirements for advanced life in the system. Okay, I looked at the exoplanet catalog yesterday, and we got a new update. It's no longer just 3,164 known planetary systems. The number is now 3,177. But in going through that, it's the same statistics I showed you previously, namely that only the solar system has known planets less than 1.4 times the mass of the Earth that orbit the host star between 0.35 and 3 astronomical units. And once again, an astronomical unit is the current distance of Earth from the Sun. And notice in our planetary system, all the rocky planets orbit between 0.35 and 3 astronomical units. We look at these 3,176 other known planetary system, they have no rocky planets orbiting within that range. Matter of fact, I want to point out, astronomers consider any planet that's more than 1.2 times the mass of the Earth likely to be a super Earth, and that means a planet that's got a huge gas envelope that would rule out the possibility of advanced life on that planet. And actually, Earth should have a huge thick atmosphere, and for a variety of reasons, it doesn't. Incidentally, Venus has an atmosphere that's as thick as we would expect from planetary formation models. It's about 90 times denser and thicker than the atmosphere of the Earth, but it's the moon forming event, among other events, that thinned out our atmosphere and also thinned out our layer of water. Or here's another statistics I can share with you. Of the known exoplanetary systems that do not orbit pulsars, 99.7% either have planets with orbital periods that are less than 80 days. Mercury has an orbital period of 88 days. Either have planets with orbital periods less than 80 days. They have super Earths, of which our planetary system has none. They've got Neptune-type planets that orbit closer to their host star than 2 astronomical units. Or they got gas giant planets that are more than 4 times Jupiter's mass, orbiting less than 3 astronomical units, or eccentricities greater than 0.1. These three categories of gas giant planets, in each case, would rule out the possibility of advanced life. And the point I'm making here, only our solar system has gas giant planets that don't fall into one of those three categories that would eliminate the possibility of advanced life. All right, let's actually look at the asteroid and comet belts in our solar system. So this is an asteroid from the main belt, and here actually shows you the 5 asteroid and comet belts. The main belt got its name because these are the easiest asteroids to see because they're the closest to the Earth. It's not the biggest asteroid belt, not even close to being the biggest asteroid belt. It's the belt that orbits between Mars and Jupiter. And as I mentioned, that belt was much bigger in the past before the Grand Tack movement than it is now. And so you basically have these asteroids orbiting halfway from Mars to Jupiter to close to Jupiter. And these bodies tend to be rocky. Some of them have as much as 10% water content, but it's not like the comets where you get 85% water content. And once you get more distant than the main belt, now you begin to predominantly see comets as opposed to asteroids. Comets are rocky bodies, predominantly rocky bodies. Comets are predominantly frozen volatiles, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, and the water. Your typical comet is about 85% frozen water, and the other 15% being made up of carbonaceous volatiles. And so you got the Centaurs. It's a relatively small belt, although it's possible it's bigger because we're detecting more of them every day. The Centaurs orbit between Jupiter and Neptune. Then you got what's called the scattered belt. And these are comets and asteroids that have very high eccentricities, which is a signature that they've had a gravitational encounter with either Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, or Neptune, and have such an extreme eccentricity that they orbit between 2 and 20 billion miles out. In other words, they've got eccentricities that'll take them from, say, 3 to 6 or 4 to 10, and some of them even the full extent of 2 to 20 billion miles. And that high eccentricity is a signature they've been scattered by gravitational interactions with Uranus, Neptune, Jupiter, and Saturn. You've got the Kuiper belt. That's the second best studied belt of asteroids and comets in our solar system. These are objects that orbit between Neptune and about 50% more distantly than Neptune. Neptune orbits at just under 4 billion miles from the sun. So between 4 and 6 billion miles out, we got these Kuiper belt objects. And then you got the biggest belt of all, which is the Oort cloud, which orbits from 10 billion out to 2 trillion miles. And incidentally, stars that are less massive than, say, twice the mass of our star, the sun, almost all of them have these Oort clouds. And these Oort clouds do bump into one another. And so because the sun tip is more massive than most of the stars in our galaxy, it has actually picked up or stolen a lot of comets and asteroids from the Oort clouds orbiting other stars. So when a star comes nearby the sun will gravitationally steal some of the objects in that star's Oort cloud. And therefore, you get a lot of chaotically orbiting objects in the Oort cloud. And some of these Oort cloud objects will be gravitationally disturbed and come into the Kuiper belt, and there they can get gravitationally disturbed and come into the inner part of the solar system. So for example, we see short period comets and long period comets. The long period comets, many of them come from the Oort cloud. Now, this is something I've written about book, Improbable Planet. I'm going to be giving a lot more detail in the next book I'm working on, just how each of these belts has fine-tuned characteristics that enables advanced life to exist on the Earth. And so it's not only necessary that the eight planets in our solar system have the characteristics they do, the masses and the orbits that they do, necessary for advanced life, that we have these five asteroid and comet belts where they're orbiting at just the right distance and just the right size. What I'm going to do before we stop and go to questions is basically look briefly at some of the benefits. You would think that we'd be better off if we didn't have any asteroids or comets at all because we wouldn't be getting any collision events. That would be a problem because we need asteroid and comet belts to deliver water to the Earth. When the moon forming event took place, our planet lost nearly all of its water. There's papers showing that it retained a little bit of that water, but not enough of all the water we see in the planet today. And so there was a later delivery of water to our planet, and that came from the asteroid and comet belt, so it's comets. And incidentally, comets are continuing to deliver water to all the solar system bodies and even the moon. I mean, if you go to the south pole of the moon, there is some frozen water there because there's a crater there with walls so high that sunlight never reaches the floor, and comets have been impacting the moon. And because they're 85% frozen water, that ice remains on the moon. Likewise, that explains the polar caps we see on Mars. Mars is such that it can't retain frozen water for very long, but it keeps getting new supplies of water from comets and impact. And if a comet hits one of the polar regions of Mars, that ice will remain, at least remain long enough until the rotation axis of Mars tilts over and that ice winds up evaporating to outer space. And our planet Earth, we do, even after the moon forming event in the late Vanir, we are still losing water to outer space. There's a very slow loss of water because we got solar ultraviolet radiation impinging our atmosphere. And as it does, it breaks apart some of the water molecules there, and that causes the hydrogen to leave. So we are getting a very slow loss of water as a result of how close we are to the sun. But the water we lose is replaced by a slow delivery of water from comets of various sizes. So yes, that's one of the benefits we get. Another benefit we get is that many of the asteroids, especially the asteroids in the Kuiper Belt and the main belt, some of these asteroids are particularly rich in heavy metals and precious metals. There are asteroids out there that are super endowed, what we call the highly siderful elements. These are elements that really like being around iron. So when you get one of these iron asteroids colliding with the Earth, they bring with it these HSEs, these highly siderophil elements. That would be elements like gold and platinum and osmium and a few other rare earths. And the reason why we have these to sustain our technology is because of the asteroid and comet belts. And incidentally, we need to give some credit to the moon. Because of the dynamics of the Earth-Moon system, both of them are being pelted by these asteroids that are very rich in these precious heavy element metals. But because of the dynamics, Earth gets 1,000 times more of these precious metals than the moon does. And so the moon actually plays a role in delivering more of these to us. And aren't you glad that we got lots of platinum and gold and all these other metals on the face of the Earth? And then what you'll see in my book, Weathering Climate Change, is that it took three asteroids, large asteroids, striking the Earth at just the right time and just the right place to get the ice age cycle started, to change the ice age cycle from a periodicity of 41,000 years to roughly 100,000 years, and to actually bring about a period of extreme climate stability. And I've actually been getting questions on my Facebook page about this paper that got published just a few days ago, making the claim that it wasn't an asteroid that brought about the Younger Dryas cooling event, but it was volcanic eruptions. And my response to that is actually in Weathering Climate Change, that we have evidence from a crater underneath 3,000 feet of ice in northwest Greenland, that's the Hiawatha ice field, that an asteroid, one of these iron-rich, heavy metal asteroids struck there, and it was at least a kilometer in diameter, and it could have been as large as 2 kilometers in diameter. And we can see the crater. We don't have a really accurate date for it, but it is a date that's consistent with the beginning of the Younger Dryas cooling event, which started about 12,800 years ago. And it's what I've written about in Improbable Planet. When you get a really big asteroid striking the Earth, especially one of these stainless steel asteroids striking the Earth, these iron-rich asteroids loaded with these precious elements, that will so disturb the crust of the Earth as to ignite volcanic reactions. So just like that, there is a debate in the scientific literature where the dinosaurs wiped out by volcanic eruptions, or were they wiped out by an asteroid that struck in the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico? The answer is not either or, it's both and. An asteroid striking the Earth of that size will cause huge volcanic eruptions to erupt. And we actually now have papers published indicating to four places of the decimal that both events happen at exactly the same time. Likewise, I would anticipate that the asteroid that struck in the Hiawatha region did ignite volcanic reactions. And incidentally, I cited papers in Weathering Climate Change that what happened in North America during the last ice age was an extremely rapid recession of the ice. In just a 1,000-year period, 3,000 feet of ice melted away. And that rapid melting of ice, and keep in mind North America, 55% of North America was covered by 3,000 feet of ice, came all the way down into Southern California. And so the melting of that ice actually caused a rebound in the North American plate, where North America basically bounced back up. And when that happened, it ignited volcanic eruptions all over North America and in Iceland as well. And therefore, and that melting was taking place just at the same time we got the beginning of the Younger Dryas cooling event. So I'm not at all surprised that we got evidence for volcanic eruptions at the same time that this asteroid hit. And the combination of the two of them indeed brought about a worldwide cooling event that lasted 1,200 years and played a crucial role in igniting this 10,000-year period of extreme climate stability. So you can read about that in Weathering Climate Change. So I've actually gone 34 minutes. I'm going to stop, but this actually finishes our series on the fine-tuning design of our planetary system. There's a lot more I could say. And hey, you're going to actually hear from Karina next week when I'll be speaking in St. Louis virtually. And she actually is a planetary astronomer. My research was in really distant galaxies and quasars. So she's actually much more of an expert in this than I am. And incidentally, there are other astronomers that are also part of this Paradoxes class. And so feel free to throw questions there. They can probably give you more up-to-date and better answers than I'm able to give here. So with that, I'm going to stop the share feature. And we'll take questions on any topic that you care to discuss until we run out of time.
Thank you, Hugh. I just want to say before we take questions that we've gotten a lot of questions over the months about the Revelation study, the 7-year Revelation study that you did many years ago. We thought it was possibly lost, but our diligent team of digital archaeologists has found it. And if you look in the chat on this broadcast, you'll find a link to it, but also at paradoxes.org, you'll find a link to it. So for all of you people who wanted to download that and listen to it, it's there, we found it. I just wanna remind everybody that if you wanna ask Dr. Ross a question, please do it through the Q&A feature on the Zoom broadcast. We're not doing it through the chat line and or through raising your hand, just the Q&A, please. So with that, Hugh, first question is from Doug McComb here in Monrovia. He has two questions, but I'm gonna ask them one at a time. He says, am I correct in assuming that the emotions of anger or even righteous indignation have no place in Christian evangelism, in apologetics or theistic debates? What do you think that God means in Ephesians 4:26 for us as Christians, quote, to be angry and sin not, or do not let the sun go down on your anger?
Okay, a good question. And I'll begin by saying that that series I did in the book of Revelation, you might wonder why it's such a long series. When the church asked me to teach on the book of Revelation, I told them, well, my understanding is that it's a capstone to all the Old Testament prophetic books. And therefore, we're going to need to study those prophetic books as well. So we wound up studying over a third of the Bible. And yes, it took 7 years and 9 months to get through all that content. A disclaimer, that was recorded between 30 and 40 years ago. I think there's one part where I did an update in the 90s, but sometime I'd like to do another update. But this is what's available. And some people jokingly refer to it as a seven-year tribulation, the course that I taught. Okay, that's now available. And again, thank you. Mark Perez really deserves credit for doing the digital archaeology to dig that out and make it available to all of us. So thank you, Mark. And incidentally, I want to indicate that next week when I'm actually teaching in St. Louis, you can pose questions to Karina, you can pose questions to the other astronomers, you can also pose questions to Ross and to Mark. Ross and Mark have been with Paradoxus for a long time, and they both have really deep Bible knowledge and good systematic theology. Mark is actually part of our scholar team at Reasons to Believe. He's retired from the LAPD and volunteers a day of a week for us. So we're grateful for him. But you know, again, I want you to take advantage of the co-hosts that we have here. So with respect to Doug's question, the reason you see it says, be angry and sin not, is that God is making the point, I created you as emotional beings. As emotional beings, you're going to experience a full range of emotion. And so it's normal that things will happen in your life that make you upset, that make you angry. But what that text is saying is, don't let the sun go down on your anger. Deal with it. Because anger can easily turn to bitterness. And bitterness, as the Bible tells us, can be a very destructive force in your life. It can actually impact your physical health. And so for physical health reasons alone, it's wise not to let your anger degrade into bitterness where it begins to eat away at you and make you less loving towards other people. And, you know, my experiences being on the pastoral staff of our church for the past four decades is that the problem is that we typically get bitter about things where we ourselves are struggling. And so I think it's a good idea to look at, okay, what is it that makes me angry? What is it that causes me to allow my anger to become bitterness where I hang on to it and begin to nurse it in some respects? Typically, often, not always, but often, there's something about yourself that you don't really appreciate or recognize. And so the fact that you see others expressing that just alerts you all the more how much you've struggled in that area. And so anger in your life could actually be a helpful symptom that there are things in your life you need to deal with and to take care of it. And often it takes other people helping you. And so I think it's always good to make sure that you have close Christian friends, that you give them permission. Hey, if you see that I'm being bitter about something, please tell me. Because bitterness is easy to ignore, but having people around you that can say, you know what, you're overreacting here. Something's going on in your life. Do you want to talk about it? And so, it also tells us that Satan and his demons can take advantage of our bitterness to worm their ways into our lives. So for that reason alone, it's good to take care of your bitterness and recognize that God has called us to forgive. After all, he's forgiven us of offenses far worse than anyone's ever committed against us. And that's something you actually see in Matthew chapter 7, that one of the conditions of coming to faith in Jesus Christ and receiving eternal life is that you be able to forgive other people as the Father in heaven has forgiven you through the work of Christ on the cross. That's actually going to be part of what I'll be talking about in our new series on suffering.
Thank you, Hugh. Juan is listening to us from Colombia. He says, do you think of the spiritual world as a specific dimension, or could it be several different dimensions?
That's a good question. God has created a separate dimensional realm for the angels than he has for us. And he's given angels the power to come into our dimensional realm and to exit our dimensional realm. With respect to us human beings, he's constrained us during our physical lives here on Earth to the dimensions of the universe. And I think the question is being raised by Juan is, for the angels and the demons, are there multiple independent dimensional realms or just one? And my response to that is, the Bible is silent on that issue. The Bible really focuses on what we, our human realm. It doesn't have that much to say about the angelic realm. The Bible is explicit that God created the angels long before he created us. Book of Job chapter 38 tells us that they were witnesses to God laying down the foundations of the earth. So they've been here a lot longer than we have. There's a lot of questions that we're going to get answers to once we exit this life and enter the next life, as we go from this dimensional realm to the dimensional realm of the dead in Christ. I think that's one of the questions you can ask there. But right now, we really don't know. But it is clear that there is a distinct dimensional realm for the angels.
Thank you, Hugh. Another excellent question from Stephen Posta in Spring, Texas. He says, there is an alternative theory of dynamics called MOND that proposes there is no such thing as dark matter. From strictly a physics perspective, is that possible?
Okay, MOND, it stands for Modified Newtonian Dynamics, where this is being proposed as an alternative to general relativity or a complement to general relativity. And you'll see a lot of papers on the NASA archive of research papers for MOND. If you put that in, it literally over 100 research papers will pop up. And what I appreciate about physics and astronomy is the fact that the journals actually encourage the publication of alternate models to challenge the current models. There's really very, very strong evidence that the dynamics of the universe is 100% explained by the theory of general relativity. But even so, astronomers have not stopped challenging general relativity. And so this is why I keep writing articles on the reasons.org website about the latest tests of general relativity. I mean, people have written me and said, why don't physicists and astronomers just give up on this? The reason why they don't give up, in spite of the very strong evidence for general relativity, they see value in continuing to put general relativity to a more and more a rigorous test. And part of that, too, is the motivation. Maybe if we put it to sufficiently rigorous tests, we'll actually find laws of physics that we haven't recognized yet, or constants of physics we haven't recognized yet, or particles we haven't discovered, recognized yet, that actually will fine-tune what general relativity generally describes. Probably the strongest evidence in favor of the MOND model would be the fact that the dynamics of galaxies and groups of galaxies. People have made the comment that if you actually look at the structure and the dynamics of galaxies, there's a way to better explain that with the MOND model, where it complements general relativity as opposed to general relativity explaining everything. However, there's been responses to all of those claims. And I've actually written about this in the book I'm working on right now, how in terms of the latest research on the dynamics of the galaxies, I'm really not seeing a good case for MOND. And that's been the trend of the last 3 years, is that what we thought was positive evidence for MOND basically is being eroded away as we continue to study the populations and the dynamics of galaxies and the behavior of dark matter. I mean, the same thing. People have been saying maybe dark matter is not all it's claimed up to be. But again, we're seeing continuing evidence for dark matter. This debate is not over. There's still a debate going on about whether or not MOND has any validity. But at least my opinion is, reading the scientific literature, the case for MOND is getting progressively weaker and weaker as we learn more and more. But it's not dead yet, but it's heading that direction, in my opinion.
Thank you, Hugh. Brian in Lead City, Texas says, is God actively adjusting the universe and Earth's natural processes for our benefit, or does he not interfere?
Well, he's not interfering now. For 6 days, God creates. On the seventh day, he stops. And there's no evening and morning for the seventh day in Genesis 1. And we got both Psalm 95 and Hebrews 4 telling us that we're still in God's seventh day. And the seventh day is when God stops intervening in miraculous ways in creation. It doesn't mean he's not intervening in other ways. I do believe he's miraculously intervening in the lives of human beings. But in terms of his interventions in nature, that's not happening during the human era. And I think this is important because it actually allows us to test the God hypothesis, in the sense that any science that we do in the human era will reveal 100% natural process. So science, where we look at what's going on before the human era, if we see significant differences with what we're observing and testing in the human era, this qualifies as evidence for the supernatural handiwork of God. And the evidence we see there is predominantly for God working with the laws of physics, not independent of the laws of physics. This is important because a lot of atheists think that we Christians believe that when God performs a miracle, it's always outside the laws of physics. That does happen when Jesus walked on water, when he rose bodily from the dead. That was God operating beyond the laws of physics. But as you look at the Old Testament, most of the miracles you see described there are miracles that can happen within the laws of physics, but require supernatural control of those laws of physics. An analogy I would raise is that a natural process like a hurricane going through Minnesota is not gonna stir up the iron ore there and turn it into an airplane. It's gonna take humans mining that ore, processing that ore, and manufacturing different components that can be assembled into an airplane. So you do need intelligence, you need knowledge, you need significant intervention, powerful intervention to counteract the laws of thermodynamics in order to bring that about. And that's actually what I'm claiming God is doing, is that he's working with the material of the universe within the laws of physics, but he's using his intellect, his knowledge, and his supernatural power to manufacture outcomes that would never happen if the natural process were running on its own. So now, and I may have missed part of that. So Ross, if I didn't answer that question completely, help me.
No, I think you got it.
Okay, good.
Yeah. And I just want to say to Doug, he asked a two-part question, and if I get two-part questions, I'm going to ask them as two separate questions and kind of spread them.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So many questions. So if that gets reposted, I will ask it. But please understand, I can't do two-part questions. We've got like 13 open questions right now. So another question, really good question from Stephen Posta. He says, when planet gets kicked out of star systems, where do they go? And do we have any idea what the average number of ejected planets per star system are?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, That's the search that astronomers are looking for now, what do we call orphan planets, planets that would be orbiting between different stars. And we haven't discovered any yet, but based on what we know about the way planets form and what happens after they form, we do expect that there's been many planet ejections. And so, yes, there should be planets roaming around in interstellar space. And if people have actually been speculating, is it even possible to consider life on planets that are orbiting in between the stars? So you'll find some papers published on that. But yeah, I'm convinced there's got to be lots of planets out there. That's a question you can pose to Karina next week. It'd be interesting to hear from her how many of these, what they call rogue planets or interstellar planets, actually exist out there.
Next question is from Scott, who lives in Seattle. He says, in simple terms, if possible, how can scientists even know about the migration of the gas giants like Jupiter?
Well, they know about the migration because we find so many of these gas giant planets orbiting relatively close to their host stars. I mean, the majority of the gas planets that have been discovered are orbiting interior to the orbit of the Earth, up at their host stars. And we know they can't form there. There's not enough volatiles there to form these gas giant planets. They have to form outside that ice line. That ice line is where the temperature drops to about 150 degrees Kelvin. And that's where you're gonna have frozen water, frozen carbon dioxide, frozen methane, and ammonia. And that would explain why you have these planets like Neptune and Saturn and Jupiter that are so very rich in gases. But the fact that they wind up close to the host stars tells us they must have migrated inward from the place where they initially formed. Again, that'd be a great question to pose to Karina next week.
Thank you, Hugh. Our friend Tim Hogle here in the LA area says, is there a dynamic reason that explains why the Grand Tack occurred in a stable orbital configuration? It happened only once and then restabilized in the present configuration.
Yeah, good question. And because we can easily imagine scenarios where we got Jupiter and Saturn coming into a 2-3 mean motion resonance, where you got Jupiter making three orbits for every two orbits of Saturn, and then they migrate outward and they wind up in a 1-2 resonance, or you get a resonance with Jupiter and Saturn with Uranus and Neptune that destabilizes the solar system. You know, I've been reading research papers on how just very tiny shifts in the orbital position of any of the four gas planets in our solar system is enough to destabilize the solar system. And actually, even a tiny motion of Venus could have an impact. And so there's lots of ways to destabilize our solar system. One of the miracles of our solar system is we got these eight planets orbiting at just the right distance with just the right masses, just the right mass ratios of one another, that our system remains stable enough for advanced life for such a long period of time. So, and what's interesting too is that you actually, for example, if you were to have Mars, it's now orbiting at 1.524 astronomical units. If it was orbiting at 1.587, it would be in a 1-4 mean motion resonance with Jupiter, where it'd be making four orbits for every single orbit of Jupiter. And that's enough to cause a destabilization. And so, yeah, I mean, you can look at the orientations of the different planets, the orbital distances, and it's amazing how close they come to destructive mean motion resonances. But in every case, we're just far enough away where that kind of thing doesn't happen. I mean, the worst we get is we get an asteroid striking us once in a while. But as I mentioned, there's some real benefits that we get from that. What I didn't mention today, by the way, is that 80% of the gold that's in industrial distribution came from an asteroid that struck in South Africa. 50% of the nickel that's in industrial circulation comes from an asteroid that struck in Ontario, Canada. And so our society really has greatly benefited from asteroids that hit tens of millions of years ago. So it's interesting because, I mean, a lot of these asteroids that come in with very high nickel content or very high gold content.
Thank you, Hugh. Our friend Mark Durham, who's an ecologist here in Monrovia, says, assuming a fifth inner planet once existed in the solar system, where would it have lined up with the other rocky planets' orbits and the ice line?
Yeah, there's good evidence now that our solar system began with at least 10 planets, five rocky planets, and five gas planets. One of those rocky planets, Theia, collided with the Earth. And by the way, a new paper came out that resolves a debate that's been going on for the last 3 years about whether the planet that collided with the Earth to form the Moon and boost the mass of the Earth was 10% the mass of the Earth, or as much as 50% the mass of the Earth. New research now shows it's between 11 and 15%. And so this has really helped us understand the moon forming event to a much greater degree as in the past. A paper was published less than 2 weeks ago making the point that this idea that the moon had the same elemental composition as the Earth and therefore required that the two bodies that merged with one another in the moon forming event had to have approximately the same masses. We now know that actually that's not the case. The lunar material that's close to the surface of the moon, that is the mantle of the moon and the crust of the moon, is similar to what we see in the crust and the mantle of the Earth, but the interior of the moon is very different than the interior of the Earth. And therefore, it's certainly possible that the body could have been a lot smaller, and it could have been orbiting actually more distantly from the Earth than, because a lot of people saying it had to be sharing the same orbit. None of that is necessary, and it's actually made possible a much more detailed moon-forming event. But I'll tell you this, it also means we got a lot more fine-tuning than we thought of in the past. So I may have forgotten everything that Mark was asking. So did I get it all or not?
No, I think so. Well, he said, where would it have lined up with other rocky planets' orbits and the ice line?
Okay, I think he's referring to the third ice giant, ice planet. I mean, our solar system's got two gas giant planets, Jupiter and Saturn, and started off with three ice planets, which would be Uranus, Neptune, and a third planet, coming in probably about 10 times the mass of the Earth. And only Jupiter and Saturn made significant migration inward. Uranus and Neptune made a very slight inward migration, very tiny indeed, and then moved outward. And likewise, this third ice planet would not have made any significant inward movement. And so it would have had virtually no dynamical impact on the rocky planets in our solar system. Neptune, as I mentioned last week, got kicked out from about 12 times the distance that Earth is from the Sun to 30 times the distance that Earth is from the Sun. This third one got kicked way farther out and maybe even completely ejected from the solar system. If it exists orbiting the Sun, it's orbiting the Sun between about 50 and 100 times the orbit of Neptune. And there's a search going on for that planet right now. But this Grand TAC model that I was talking about works either way. It does require that this third ice planet must have existed and must have been ejected outward and either got completely ejected or just ejected to a very, very distant orbit about the Sun.
Thank you, Hugh. We'll get back to Doug from Monrovia. He says, where did all of the asteroids in our solar system come from? Are any of them the remains of Theia colliding with the Earth or from other collisions or did all of that coalesce with the moon and the earth?
It actually goes back earlier than that, because when the sun forms, like all stars about the size of the sun, it forms this big disk of gas and dust and debris. We call it the protoplanetary disk. And the planets form out of that protoplanetary disk. But when they form, they do not consume all the stuff that's in the protoplanetary disk. And so the asteroids and the comets are basically the leftover remains from planet formation in our solar system. And again, we got Karina, who's much more expert on this than I am. That'd be a great question to pose to her next week. Karina, I hope I'm not putting you too much on the spot here, but I'm really glad that you're going to be here next week.
Great. Thank you, Hugh. Ryan from Pennsylvania says he saw an article where Japanese scientists believe they found microbes from 18,000 feet below the ocean surface and have been, and that they have been there for 100 million years and that they were able to start growing them again. Is this accurate? And if so, how is it possible?
It is accurate. This is referred to as benthic life, microbes that exist at the bottom of the ocean and exist even interior to the bottom where they burrow their way into the seafloor. And there's very little energy there. And how these microbes survive is they have extremely low metabolic rates. And they got the capacity to go into a hibernation phase. And what these scientists have discovered is evidently these microbes have been hibernating not just for years, but literally for millions of years. And once you bring back an energy supply, they are able to come back and begin to operate. But yeah, benthic life, all of those microbes are designed in such a way as to survive on very little energy, because there's hardly any energy there available to them or food supply. There are places in the ocean where you get a significant deposit of the broken up remains of bacteria and viruses, and they settle on the bottom of the ocean floor and can provide a food supply, but it's not a big food supply. So those life forms have to, and by the way, a lot of people have speculated that this is the origin of all life on planet Earth, but the metabolic rates are so extremely low that these are microbes that have no potential for evolution, not even microevolution, because of their extremely low metabolic rates, and also how they have to, some of them are actually living under high temperature and high pressure conditions, which means that they're basically also have to be designed with the biochemical machinery to repair damage, because these are creatures that are being damaged big time. And then again, the little bit of energy they have basically has to all go to damage repair rather than reproduction or any other form of work or energy.
Thank you, Hugh. Tim Williams asks, how much evidence do you think God has given us for his existence in order to encourage belief while also promoting the goodness of living a life here on Earth?
Well, he's given us enough evidence that we're all without excuse, as it says in Romans chapter 1. I mean, I've got a neighbor, and she has right on her front door there. This is a home where we worship God, and if you don't, look outside, basically making the point, hey, just look around you. What we see around us is so extraordinarily beautiful and elegant and complex. Some mind had to make it all. Some mind has got incredible knowledge and intellect and a great power in order to pull this all off. So the evidence for God is everywhere, and then we look at everything he's provided, and to realize this is a God that has enormous love for us, because look how richly he's provided for us. And he's also made it possible for us to enjoy this life here on Earth. I mean, I think the few decades we have here on Earth is basically preparing us for a future career in the new creation. But I love the way that God has made our lives here on earth with enough suffering, if you like, to prepare us for those future careers, but also as a way where we can really enjoy life here on earth. And he actually expects us to really appreciate and enjoy what he's created. You know, life is good. Life can be hard, but life can be good too, given everything that God has provided. And so we were looking at a very generous God. I think that's why it's important that we say grace with every meal. Just realize, you know, if there was no God, there'd be no food. And if it was any other kind of God, all of our food would look like cardboard, taste like cardboard, and have the texture of cardboard. And how unpleasant dinner would be if that was the case. And so I think it's important to remind ourselves just how generous our God has been and how beautiful and glorious he's made everything.
Thank you, Hugh. Keith in New Zealand says, why was the primordial earth so poor in heavy metals compared with asteroids and comets? Thank you.
Earth is actually extremely rich in these heavy metals. But keep in mind, the heavy stuff will tend to sink into the interior of the earth. And so as we look at the earth, it's probably the most heavy metal rich body in the universe. So for example, if you compare the abundance of uranium and thorium in the crust of the earth with what we would anticipate would be the case for rocky bodies elsewhere in the universe, based on what we can measure in our galaxy and other galaxies, you come to the conclusion that Earth has 340 times as much uranium as any other rocky body and 630 times as much thorium. And it's all that uranium and thorium that makes possible, because there's going to be way more of it in the interior of the Earth, and that's what makes possible our plate tectonics, the heat release from uranium, thorium, and the potassium decay. And that's also what enables us to have a strong magnetic field that protects us from deadly solar and cosmic radiation. And now, what did we have initially? I would agree that when Earth was formed, it didn't have as many of these heavy metals as it has right now. The moon forming event actually caused more Earth to receive more of those heavy metals than the moon did. And so we got enriched there. We got enriched by other means. And the reason why we see these asteroids that are like pure stainless steel, complemented with all these precious heavy metals, is that if you look, if you were to break up the Earth, for example, the core of the Earth would be like these asteroids. And so about a quarter of the asteroids in the main belt are what we call metal asteroids. And what's interesting is some of those asteroids have better grades of stainless steel than we manufacture here on Earth. And so, yes, that asteroid that struck in Ontario, that's been a place where people have gone just because of how much nickel is in that asteroid that struck there. And that's in circulation to this day. So, we are richer than we were in the past, but even in the past, we were extremely rich compared to what we expect for the rocky bodies the size of the Earth.
Thank you, Hugh. Darius has a good question. He says, thank you for your talk, first of all. Says, when you mention the creation of Adam and Eve, do you mean this literally? Because our current understanding of evolution states that the earliest life formed approximately 4 billion years ago, and life then evolved from this complex tree. The main idea is that modern humans appeared about 200,000 years ago.
Well, before we did this series on the designs of our solar system, we did a series on human origins. And you'll actually see an article that's posted at reasons.org on the dating methods for dating the origin of human beings, and basically making the point that once you get earlier than about 45,000 years ago, we don't have any direct dating tool method. We have dating methods that have very significant systematic effects. And so when you see in the published literature that the date for the origin of human beings is 200,000 years ago, if you actually look at both the statistical and the systematic errors, that's 200,000 plus or minus about 200,000. The best date I've seen is 150,000 years ago, plus or minus 150,000. Although the minus wouldn't be that big, because we do have carbon 14 dates that show us that humans have been present on Earth for at least the past 45,000 years. And if you look at what you see in the book of Genesis, Genesis 2 tells us that God created Adam and Eve when four known rivers, two which still flow today, came together in the Garden of Eden. That location today is more than 200 feet below sea level, but during the last ice age would have been above sea level. So just based on what you see in Genesis chapter 2, apparently God created Adam and Eve during the last ice age, although I've seen some theologians that said, well, the Bible doesn't rule out it could have been the ice age before. But I think there's good evidence based on these other dating methods that God created Adam and Eve during the last ice age, simply because there's three epochs, known epochs during the last ice age, where you got possible easy, rapid migration from the Persian Gulf to East Africa and from East Africa to the Persian Gulf, which would explain why the earliest artifacts that we can attribute to human beings show up in both locations. But yeah, you can, that's all archived at paradoxes.org, the video recordings of that series we did in Human Origins. And I would check that out. But yeah, just be aware that those dates for the origin of human beings have rather substantial errors.
I think, Hugh, the thrust of his question has more to do with, do you take the creation of Adam and Eve to be something God did literally or through the process of evolution?
No, I believe that it was a literal creation event, because what you'll see in that series that's archived at paradoxes.org is I reviewed the evidence for the uniqueness of human beings relative to Neanderthals, the Denisovans, Homo erectus, the Australopithecines, Homo habilis, etc. Is there's a huge difference between humans. And I argue this is one of the platforms of the Christian faith. Is one platform is the universe has a beginning. Another is that God created us human beings with distinct features relative to all their life on planet Earth. And so what I did in this series is point out the distinctives between human beings, for example, and the Neanderthals and the Denisovans. I focused a lot on that because there are many people claiming in the scientific literature that the Neanderthals are as fully human as we are. And so I basically respond to that, citing literature that basically makes the point, no, we really have distinct capabilities, anatomical features that distinguish us, and DNA that separates us from the Neanderthals and Denisovans. According to the Bible, humans and humans alone, of all the creatures God placed on the earth, has a spiritual component. We see no evidence for that in any of the bipedal primates that preceded human beings. Incidentally, I take it one step beyond that. I believe all of the bipedal primate species that existed before God created Adam and Eve, likewise, were special creation events. Based on population field studies that show us that mammals, at least terrestrial mammals, that have an adult body size bigger than 3 kilograms will go extinct before they can evolve into anything that we would call a separate species of mammals. And explains too why we've seen 4,000 mammal species go extinct during the human era, and we've seen zero new ones come into existence. And actually spent some time explaining why God would go to the trouble of creating these bipedal primate species. They actually play a critical role in making possible the launch of human civilization. Those species basically trained the large body size bird and mammals to avoid tall creatures on two legs with weapons in their hands. And so God creating these different species at the times that he did and the population levels that he did actually played a role in making it possible that these animals that are so important for launching human civilization didn't get wiped out by the early humans. I think it's important too to realize the latest evidence now tells us that the Neanderthal population sizes were not very large. At most, there might have been 25,000 Neanderthals on the Earth at one time. Much more likely that the numbers were around 5,000. And so with numbers that small, you're not going to get any kind of conceivable evolutionary mechanism. I don't know of any evolutionists who would argue that that can happen at population numbers that small. And see even smaller population numbers for the Denisovans. And when you look at Homo erectus was on the face of the earth for at least 200,000 years. But the earliest specimens we see show no change with respect to the latest. We can't observe any evolutionary change in the morphology of the earliest Homo erectus and the latest Homo erectus. Incidentally, that's true for all the bipedal primates, is that we can't observe any significant change in the morphology. And with respect to the Neanderthals, where we got DNA, we can't see any significant change in the DNA over the 150,000 years minimum they were on the face of the Earth.
Thank you, Hugh. I think we have time for one more question. David Edwards writes from Santa Margarita, California. How do MOND and general relativity tie in with quantum theory? Does one fit better than the other, and are we any closer to a unified field theory?
Well, the distinctions between MOND and general relativity don't show up at the level of quantum mechanics. They show up in terms of the dynamics of large structures in the universe, like galaxies and galaxy groups. That's where you see a distinction between the two models. As I mentioned earlier, I think those are being resolved in favor of a general relativity and against the MOND model. And Ross, there's some other part of that question. Can you help me with it?
Yeah, he says, does one fit better than the other, and are we any closer to a unified field theory?
Yeah, I would argue, based on the latest research, that general relativity is fitting better than MOND. And that, are we any closer to a unified field theory? We're a little bit closer, thanks to the discovery of the Higgs boson at the Large Hadron Collider, because that was a predicted particle from our unified field theory. So that discovery helped. And that's actually motivation to try to build an even bigger particle accelerator. There's plans to build an even bigger one. It's not cheap. You know, even the Large Hadron Collider was $10 billion. So we're looking at coming up with significantly more money to build a bigger one. But I remember a lecture from Alan Guth many years ago, where he said, if we really want to get to the bottom of a unified field theory, and you know, forget about trying to bring gravity into it, that'll never happen. But just even to bring in a full unification of the electromagnetic force with the nuclear weak force and the nuclear strong force, we would need a particle accelerator 40 trillion miles long. And he said the chances of that being funded are very remote in the U.S. budgetary process right now. He made some more political comments, but I'm not going to do that about that. However, we do have particle accelerators that have shown us the full unification of the electromagnetic force with the weak nuclear force. And we're partway to the strong nuclear force. But yes, we'll never have the technology to develop a complete unified theory, even for just three of the four forces of physics, let alone that for gravity. The discovery of gravity waves, incidentally, also was more evidence in favor of a unified field theory. So that discovery a couple of years ago was a factor. But for example, it's well understood. Yes, we can detect gravity waves. We'll never be able to detect gravitons. There's no conceivable technology. But that's another prediction of the unified field theory, that there's these particles, gravitons, that would exist. But yeah, we're not going to find those just because of, again, the technological limitations. Yeah, if you want to bring in the unification of gravity, now you need a particle accelerator that goes all the way out to the most distant quasar and galaxies. So that's not going to happen either. However, I don't know of any physicist who isn't convinced that unified field theory is correct. And for those of you who are not familiar with this, I'll give you a home analogy. You can take a bar magnet, and if you heat that bar magnet up, the magnetism will disappear. It doesn't really disappear. What happens is, as you heat it up, the heat energy and the magnetic energy blend together. Same thing physicists believe is the case with the universe. When God created the universe, it was infinitesimally small and nearly infinitely hot. But as it expanded, it cooled. And as it cooled, the one force of physics first split into two forces of physics, then three forces of physics, and the four forces we have today. We can recreate in particle accelerators the temperature necessary to unify the electromagnetic force and the weak nuclear force. That was done in the 1970s, where they produced the energy density to achieve that. And lo and behold, they saw the two forces link together and become one force. So we call that the electroweak force. But we don't have the capability of duplicating the energy density to see the strong electroweak force.
Hugh, thank you so much. We're out of time. I want to remind everybody that next week we're going to have the privilege of having Karina Macau on. She's a planetary astronomer. Hugh's going to be speaking to a church in St. Louis. So thank you again, Hugh. Would you please, and next week we're going to be starting at 10:45 instead of 10:30. So Hugh, would you please close us in prayer?
Sure. Father in heaven, thank you for this time we've had together with you. Thank you for these amazing people that are participating in this class. And Father, I pray that you would richly bless them. And Father, give us opportunities to be a blessing to others, to share what we've learned in the book of nature, to encourage people to study and to receive truth and life from the book of scripture. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, with that, I'll stop the recording.